This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. It's Friday, and because of that, I am joined, as always, by Dr. in the House, Dr. George Lee.
Welcome. Good afternoon,
to the show. Hello. And today we also have with us Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, Senior Consultant Oncologist and Head of Department of Oncology at Hospital University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
We have both of you here today, and coincidentally, we will all be seeing one another tomorrow as well.
Yes, I'm very excited.
Are you?
On the eve of our big event, right?
Yes, it is. Tomorrow, of course, is BFM Health and Living Live 2016 at Connection at Nexus Bangsa South. Dr. Fuad and I will be on the same panel talking about cancer, yes.
Oh, Lynn, I'm very jealous.
I know.
Why are you
not
moderating my session?
Well, you have Mira.
Oh, really?
So, yes.
Oh, dear. I'm going to be punished again. She's going to interrogate me.
So I think you're going to do just fine.
No, this is not fair. Fuad, this is not fair. Can we do a swap?
No, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, but
I think I'd like to see Mira
live. All right. Okay, right. But, I mean, you're the clever doctor. It's like, you know, the real doctor who is going to talk about real issues, right?
Well, we're going to be talking about the management of cancer. Mm. So it's a whole bunch of different things. And we'll have representatives from different parts, I guess, of the medical setup. So I think hopefully we'll be giving a holistic view. But today, specifically, we're talking about a therapy that's come out that retrains the body's immune system to fight cancer. It's created a lot of excitement after more than 90% of terminally ill patients went into remission. But the data has not been published or reviewed yet. And two patients are said to have died from an extreme immune response. So that's the topic of today's show.
When that was published at BBC, I was very, very excited. I mean, but that reminded me that, so many years ago, we started having this so-called immunotherapy in air quotes. I mean, those were the days when you actually had renal cancer. And then those were old systems of interferon, IL-2. But it has evolved right now. And in this particular study, although it kind of excited many people, with palliative therapy, that despite being called terminal ill, but there were some responses. I mean, these are kind of like bespoke treatment of manipulations of T killer cells in order to do that. So we're very, very pleased to have you here today, because you can talk about, you know, what are the major advances in oncology, really.
Yes, this study certainly is very interesting. And the idea of getting your own body to attack your cancer is very exciting. It's been around for a long time,
right?
At least 20 or 30 years. But this is something really new and something that looks like a bit of a breakthrough.
Yeah. I mean, what exactly is immunotherapy?
Immunotherapy essentially is harnessing your own body's immune system to try to recognize cancer cells and try to attack them. We've got a lot of immune cells in our body. They are very active against things like viruses and bacteria, because these are cells which are completely different from your cells. So they recognize this as foreign, and the cells recognize, okay, you don't belong in our body, and then they attack the cells and they produce some proteins and destroy the cells. The problem with cancer is that cancer is from your own body. So it looks almost the same as like your normal cells, and our immune system do not recognize them. It's a problem of recognition. So if you liken it to a person, they've got the same black hair, they've got the same body size and so on, so the immune system goes past them. So what we need to do is to retrain the immune system so that they recognize this as your own cells, but they've gone bad, and recruit the cells, other cells in the immune system to come and attack them and destroy the cancer cells. So it's very exciting.
This might seem like a bit of a silly question. I'm going to preface it with that. As the only non-medical person here, it might be a little bit off base, but whenever I read about autoimmune diseases, they always sound incredibly frightening. The idea that the body will turn against itself is one that seems, you know, and once it kind of spirals with autoimmune diseases, I've always found them particularly sort of very threatening, because it's your own body using itself against
yourself.
Which is kind of what this sounds like. So is it more controlled than that? I mean, is it kind of a similar base, but how do you kind of keep it contained once you've trained your body to be militant about your own body?
What a great question.
Yes, that's really, really a good question, because autoimmune is the body doesn't recognize anybody as a friend. So the cells come and assumes everybody is as enemy and knocks out different cells in your body part. So here we're looking at something specific. So let's just say the cancer is 95% looks almost like your cells. So we need to find that 5% difference. Maybe the hair is a bit longer. Mm. So the body recognizes, okay, anybody with long hair, that's the cancer cell. We're going to attack just those with long hair. Or the hair is curly. Or instead of five fingers, you've got four fingers. So these are the small differences in the cancer cell that we want to train the body to recognize. And that's one of the ways is you kill off the cancer cells, and then you show them, okay, this is the picture of the cancer cell. It's got long hair. Find every cell with long hair. It's almost like that. Otherwise, the body goes past. It looks like, okay, this guy is about 5 foot. It looks almost the same like normal. I'm going to let him go by. So that's one of the ways. The other way is that the cancer cells are also quite smart in the way that when the cells may be there, and they're going to attack the cells, and suddenly it produces like a card. Okay, this is my IC. I belong into Malaysia. So it's almost like that.
Get out of jail free.
Exactly.
Like card. That, right, okay. Very clever. I mean, Lynn pointed out something that is interesting because that drew a lot of recollections of what it was like, because initially when we tried to treat kidney cancer with just inflammatory exudates, like, you know, IL-2 or interferon, those days, because it's so generic, it makes people feel ill, flu-like symptoms, and it attacks everything. It causes a lot of, you know, secretions in lungs and things like that. Is that what you're saying, that with the advance of technology, research and everything like that, we are fine-tuning it so that it can be more specific? Is that what's happening now?
Yes, it is. It is. And even if you look at the difference of immune therapy that's come forward, in a way, say Herceptin, mm-hmm. it is an antibody. In a way, it's an immune therapy. It attacks the cell. But at the same time, because the antibody is fairly specific to the HER2 protein, mm-hmm. then this antibody attracts other immune cells, and they do the normal cell killing through the antibody. So again, there is some sort of immune therapy.
Okay, you have to excuse me. I'm a urologist after all. If I recollect correctly, Herceptin is for breast cancer. Is that
right?
That's right,
yeah.
Okay, and then this is an antibody that's raised in order to attack the cancer cell. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. All right, okay. So I'm not too bad after all.
you're on the ball, George.
I'm on the ball. Whoa, that's, be careful. Say, you know, urologist on the ball here.
Well, it seems appropriate to say at this point in time. Now, we also had clinical oncologist and radiotherapist Dr. Ho Guo Fang, who was on Health and Living on March 11, talking about, well, pancreatic cancer. That was our area of the show that day. But he also said something about immunotherapy that seemed pretty promising.
If you want to cure cancer one day, it's got to be with the immune system. Why? Immune system is adaptable. It adapts to the changing environment and changing antigens. So the current breakthrough is to switch on the immune system, because tumor cells switch off the immune system. So if you activate the immune system, you can control the cancer much better.
I remember following up to that point about how long it would take for immunotherapy to become kind of as widely available as the conventional treatments that we have today. And I think whenever people hear about breakthroughs, that's kind of the thing they want to know. Mm-hmm. When is it going to hit me? So with immunotherapy, if it's the future, how far away is that future?
Yeah, you are going to get those questions tomorrow.
I think so.
That's right.
Okay. Well, the problem is this breakthroughs, you find this proof of concept that you can actually make it work, but now you have to prove that it actually works in the longer term. That's one. And then number two, we are talking about fairly customized therapy. So using this immune therapy might work for this group of people, but for group B, you might need something slightly different. You might need, instead of looking at the hair, you might have to look at the pants or something slightly different. So when it comes to customized therapy, that's when we have trouble finding the evidence for it. We're trying to find comparative group. I do agree with Dr. Ho that immune therapy is a good way forward, because the cancer evolves. When we talk about cancer, even we talk about something like breast cancer, it is not all the same cells. So you have breast cancer, which are cells A, cells B, C, D, and E, and so on. And you have the drugs that work only on A and B. Or even something like Herceptin might work on C and D. But then what about EF and all the rest? When you've killed this lot of cancer cells here, the others start to overgrow, and these are the ones who don't respond to the drug. Hopefully, with the immune system, they respond to different cells. It's like if a bacteria comes in, they will respond to that bacteria. A second bacteria comes in, it can also respond to the bacteria. So can we train it so that it recognizes all these little differences between cancer cells and normal cells?
Well, in this particular case, it was acute lymphoblastic leukemia and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Could you describe firstly what those are? And secondly, are there any particular traits about them that made them a particularly good avenue of study for this kind of therapy?
Acute leukemia is something that is a bit more common in children, but you can also get it in adults. It's essentially a disease of the blood. Both of them are lymphomas, also a disease of the blood, but they tend to affect lymph nodes. And these lymph nodes are found all over your body, especially basically around junctions in your neck, under your arms, in the center part of your body, and so on. So you would think that something that is from the blood, and our immune system is also from the blood, that if you can train them to recognize specific antigens, what we call specific differences in the cells, then you can train our T cells or natural killer cells to recognize these antigens, and they may work better on these cells. And we know that leukemias and lymphomas, in a way, the number of mutations in these cancers, I think, are less compared to solid tumors like breast cancer or colon cancer. So if you've got too many variants in a tumor, then it becomes more difficult for the immune system to adapt so many times.
Yeah, I mean, Fuad, obviously you mentioned about leukemia in children, and those are probably not as common in general population. We're going to get hundreds and hundreds of people attending the function tomorrow. Presumably many of them are interested in more common cancer, like, for example, lung cancer, yes, colon cancer, breast cancer. Yeah. So how applicable is this new era to those people?
If we look at what's happening in solid tumors, then we are looking at a slightly different system. We are not so much training the immune system, but what we are trying to do is overcome the immune blockade. What happens in the immune blockade of tumors? So you've got a bunch of tumor cells, and if you actually remove the tumors, you find that there are cells which are purely cancer cells, but you also find the immune cells. But why aren't the immune cells working, killing these cells? It's again what I call the IC system. So the cancer cells flashes its IC and says, okay, I am a Malaysian, please ignore me and go away. So this is what we call a receptor, PD-L1 receptor. So we can find a way to say, take away its IC, and they say, no, we recognize that this is a counterfeit and we're going to attack you. So that's what's happening with this new drug called pembrolizumab. So we are attacking this. We are removing the blockade. We are removing the way of their masking themselves from the immune system. And so the immune cells now recognize them as alien cancer cells and attack them. So that has worked in at least in lung cancer, and I believe it's also been approved for breast cancer. So that seems to be the way forward, at least for solid tumours for the time being.
Wow. I mean, that's quite exciting, really, isn't it? I mean, those are published data. Are these drugs available for general public in the States or in Malaysia?
Yes, they are approved now for the States, and they are approved for the later stages of cancer. That means after you fail conventional chemotherapy first, so then they are approved when you've got fairly limited options. So we are now in the phase of trying to move them forward in the earlier phases. So instead of going for chemotherapy, perhaps if the data is good, then you can go for this drug first. Because one of the things about these targeted therapies and immune therapies is that they are getting more specific now, and the side effects from this treatment should be much less than getting conventional chemotherapy.
And that's something that I want to pick up on. After this, we're taking a short break. I'm joined today by Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, Senior Consultant Oncologist, as well as Dr. George Lee, our doctor in the house. Together, we're talking about how immunotherapy could be, you know, possibly a cure for cancer. Right now, it's certainly possibly a cure for terminal blood cancer. I'm using possibly a lot, but that's just
possibly
to manage expectations. Mm. Up next, we'll touch a little bit on the difference between conventional and alternative modes of treatment for cancer. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin with our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. And we're joined by Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, senior consultant oncologist, who's also going to be part of the Managing Cancer panel tomorrow at BFM Health and Living Live 2016. So if you find our questions unsatisfactory today, you know, if you're thinking, I have more questions, show up tomorrow and ask the questions yourself. You can register by going on to bfm.my/health. Now, we're looking in particular at this one therapy that's been proven to work for terminal blood cancers. And that word terminal I find very interesting, because they went clearly from being terminal to not terminal. You know, these were patients for whom you'd said, okay, this is, you know, last frontier and there's no more hope.
Another great question, Sam. You know, Fuad, put you on the spot again trying
when
to...
When is someone
decide.
Terminal?
I know, I feel like I'm being ambushed.
I'm sorry.
There'll be more tomorrow.
Yes.
Well, usually when you talk about conventional therapies, whatever they are, so we'll say that, okay, let's say for breast cancer, we have got our first choice drug, second choice drug, third choice drug, fourth choice drugs, and so on. But after some time, patients may run out of options. Then we say that we really don't have anything that seems to work well for somebody like in your case. So we are going to focus on reducing your symptoms or palliative care. Then we say they are in the advanced stages where the conventional therapy is more likely to create harm rather than good. And we'll say that we need to take you off all the chemotherapy and whatever not, and focus on keeping you well, focus on getting rid of your symptoms and so on. So they are, in a way, they say that they are terminal in a way because they've got no other drug choices, and then some of them may go on these experimental therapies. So this seems to be a good time. I've got no good conventional treatment anymore. Let's try a new drug, which is not proven but may work because it's, the mechanism of action seems to be good. So this is what we mean by they're in terminal phase, but they are still eligible for certain experimental therapies.
Well, on that note, last week on Talkback Thursday on the evening edition, we asked listeners what their main health concerns are. And a number of calls, including this one from Faisal, mentioned cancer.
Well, my main concern is basically cancer because my family history and my past history of being diagnosed with brain cancer, and I had another scare of a cancer scare this year. So it's pretty much just like that's kind of what I'm really concerned, especially in Malaysia where we don't have the alternative form of medication that like I was receiving when I was back in the States. So chemotherapy, even though it's the main form of treatment, but it's kind of it's a harsh form and it's really painful to go through the post cycle again.
Is there an issue there with that lack of availability of alternative modalities?
Because, you know, obviously it must be an incredibly difficult decision for you and the family to decide that you run out of options. And especially in Asia, we will have people who say, what if I would like to have that alternative therapy? And how do you respond to that sort of request?
Okay. We shouldn't say write off chemotherapy and so on to say that it's bad. If we have to go back to history a little bit, at the turn of the 20th century, if you have something like leukemia, essentially that's a death sentence. Okay, but with the advent of chemotherapy, we started about 1940s, 1950s, then a lot of leukemia, more than 50% of leukemia, I think, can be cured. So chemotherapy has got its uses. But sometimes when you have advanced cancer, then if you have especially a solid tumor, what you mean by solid tumor is like colon, breast, and lung, which has spread, then we know that the effectiveness of chemotherapy is much less. We are not likely to cure them. We can only hold them for so long. My advice would be that if you have chemotherapy, a drug, let's say for breast cancer, is likely to work 80% of the time, go for it first. But then when you come to second or third round and then the effectiveness is down to 20%, I do not turn my patients away and say, no, you cannot have your alternative therapy. If you like to try something, never mind, then we will help you in that. We will monitor your treatment and then see whether it's working or not. And in general, I tell them that, look, if we are going to try alternative therapies, we must play by the same rules. If the tumor is getting bigger, it's not working. Right? It doesn't get bigger and then becomes smaller. That doesn't happen.
I see tomorrow you're sharing the platform together with somebody who is professional.
Dr. Lim Renjai, yes, yeah, from the National nice. Cancer Institute.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, under those circumstances, do you think patients have that? You know, can the alternative therapy and conventional therapy, you know, go hand in hand for patients' treatment?
Yes, I believe they can. We are not really against alternative therapy, but we believe that we need more good research on it, right? So again, as I said, play by the same rules, okay? If you're going to go on alternative therapy, fine, you go on it. How long do you need? 1 month to see a response? 2 months? And what do you mean by response? Is it that the tumor is smaller by 5%, 10%? By conventional treatment, usually we want at least 20 to 30% reduction. So then you say it's working. If it's only 5%, you say, oh, that's not exciting at all. So we will say that if you want to go on alternative therapy, fine. Come, we'll do your scans. We will also monitor you for side effects. If you're getting diarrhea, that's a side effect. It's not the bad cells going out through your bottom or whatever it is. It's a side effect of treatment. So we play by the same rules as with chemotherapy or any other treatment for that matter.
I'm sorry to keep harping on about this notion of terminal, because I feel as if when doctors say terminal, I might not hear terminal. And I think that's a problem with chronic illnesses because they're so long, you know, so you've had it for so long and it hasn't killed you yet.
And who decides?
Exactly. So what if I have, you know, lots and lots of disposable income, if I'm one of the lucky few who, you know, who happen to be able to do that, and I hear no from you, but I think, fine, you know, I'll just fly to Singapore or I'll fly to the States and I'll find someone who'll say yes. At what point do I start hearing the no? What would your advice be for a patient to start hearing that no and, you know, maybe just...
Yeah, great question, because in reality, that's happening a lot,
all
right?
The time.
All the time, because many people are flying to China and then to get that so-called alternative or more aggressive treatment because they don't hear the word terminal coming out of your mouth, right? So, you know, I'm sure you're going to get those sort of questions tomorrow. How do you respond to that?
When you've run out of conventional therapy, but then some patients are still fit and they still want to try some alternative therapies or experimental therapies, go into clinical trials and so on, please, I think if you're well, you can go ahead and explore your options.
But there is any harm, though?
There is a possible harm. So you have to consider that. What are my chances of success? no therapy works 100%. So if you have somebody say, don't worry, I can cure you, I've cured 100% of my patients, I think you run away from that guy because that can't be true.
That guy is lying to you.
Yeah. Okay. So if somebody whose results are, you know, to the extreme right, I think he's pulling a fast one.
He's either lying to you or he's treated one person. That one person has done well.
Or follow up in one day.
And that one person has done all the marketing for him.
That's right.
So you, when you say terminally ill, is that you've tried everything else, you can spend your money, but you reach a stage where the cancer is so advanced, you can barely walk, you can barely breathe. Right, you're in pain, you cannot eat, and you've lost a lot of weight. At that point in time, I think you're really entering the terminal phase where any form of treatment is not working, and the treatment that you want to still try is maybe experimental, is more likely to do you harm than good.
Or the treatment itself make you can't walk and can't eat and actually lost all the weight.
Yes.
Right?
Sometimes that can happen as well, yeah.
How do patients cope with that kind of trade-off? Because I think that, again, as Faisal pointed out, it's a difficult treatment to go through.
Another great question, because, you know, at what point do you actually, at what price do you pay for that word cure?
Again, you have to look at the chances of cure. If you've got an advanced testicular cancer, right, I'll go all out. I will go all out. Even if you're in the ICU, you're being intubated, and I say, there is a 10% chance we can still cure you despite all the side effects, but there is still a 10% chance. Mm-hmm. Go for it, because this happened to the young men and sometimes young ladies with a similar sort of ovarian cancer. But if you have lung cancer and you're in the ICU and you have a tube in you, your chance of cure is essentially practically zero. At that point in time, you say, why do I want to give chemotherapy to somebody who's not even likely to wake up? Right, then the trade-off is there. So if you have a chance of cure, go for it.
It must be an incredible decision that you make on a daily basis.
It is. And, you know, sometimes when we give chemotherapy in the ICU, I always worry, the family must think I'm mad or something like that.
I mean,
the guy is not even awake and I want to give him chemotherapy.
On top of that, you have to balance out all the cost and emotional trauma and everything, because it's not just the patient in front of you. It's the extended baggage that comes with that patient. Is that not true?
Yeah, that's true. And again, you know, when we go for curative therapy, it's very strong. You know, you have to give them high doses of drugs, high doses of radiation, and so on. And a person who was relatively well and without much treatment, you can quickly convert him to somebody who's ill, who gets fever, who gets emitter, cannot eat, ulcers.
And the bill is piling up.
Yes, that's also another big trauma to them.
Which is why the panel is going to be on the management of cancer, not necessarily treatments, but there's just so much surrounding it to manage, I think, and people often don't think about it until they're in that situation.
Yeah, and in fact, in the panels, you actually have somebody in the talking about the insurance side of things as well,
yes,
right?
We do. We have Dr. Miralini from AIA, and I think she'll be able to provide a very valuable financial perspective to
because,
all of this.
You know, because at the end of the day, we never think that we will be put in that situation, or our loved ones, our family will be put in that situation. It will be perfect time and perfect opportunity to find out how that can be overcome, really.
Again, that's at Connection at Nexus Bangsa South tomorrow, and you can register still today. Coming back all the way to this clinical trial, which we strayed very far from, I'm sorry. This data has not been published or reviewed as yet. I mean, it's exciting, but it's not widely available. How much can we really take away from what's being reported?
We have to be a bit careful with preliminary results. Sometimes you get very exciting responses. This has happened many times before when drugs like Gleevec came about. You give this medication and within a month or 2 months, you can see that the tumours have all gone quiet. They haven't quite disappeared, but they have essentially gone to sleep. But a year later, they wake up. So the initial results looks very exciting. The tumor may have disappeared, but sometimes it can come back with a vengeance in a way. So this seems to be early results. They haven't had longer term follow up. We may not sure because cancers can evolve. So when it evolves, you have blocked pathway A, or you've made the immune system recognize them through pathway A. They change to pathway B. They're quite smart, these cancers.
Yeah, I mean, Lynn made a great point to say that a preliminary results like this create a lot of excitement, headlines and that sort of things, right? However, on the other hand, the previous caller came up with this very bad image of what conventional therapy is like. You know, painful, distressing, losing hair, radiotherapy, you know. And is that a fair depiction of the modern therapy, of chemo, immunotherapy, targeted therapy. Because for me, I feel like we have made a quantum leap compared to two decades ago. But yet we still have that bad image of chemotherapy and radiotherapy. How do you justify that?
You have to look at the circumstances when the chemotherapy was given in point. Let's go back to leukemia. Most of the, especially children, they come in very ill. They've got high temperature. They can hardly eat. They're very weak. And you give chemotherapy at that point in time. Now, usually what happens is that when you give chemotherapy, anything that happens after that is blamed on the chemotherapy. Anything. So we have patients with advanced cancers, breast cancer. They are weak. They cannot walk because they're in a lot of pain. And they come in the wheelchair. I say that you don't have much choice. You need chemotherapy because the cancer is everywhere. And they have that chemotherapy and they come again a few weeks and still in the wheelchair. And all the people remember, oh, she had chemotherapy and now she's on the wheelchair.
Oh, right.
I'm sorry, when she came earlier, she's already on the wheelchair. So that's a bit unfair.
Well, that is true because the people have that impression. But surely there are recent advances that actually reduces, their success stories that can be depicted.
There are, especially in terms of the worst side effect people consider usually is nausea and vomiting. And with the current medication, I would say that less than 20% or 30% have any significant vomiting at all. And the amount of people who actually have severe vomiting who needs to be admitted is really quite rare. I've perhaps admitted one or two patients for vomiting over the last 3 to 6 months.
So the movie portrayal of somebody who kind of like, hold on to their toilet bowls every time they have chemotherapy and they lost their hair and that sort of thing. In reality, it's not really everyone goes through that. Is that true?
Well, the hair for some parts of it is true. If you have got breast cancer, unfortunately, most of the good drugs causes you to lose your hair. But if you have colon cancer, most of the drugs do not cause you any significant hair loss. And again, I just tell the man, I said, whatever hair you've lost already, it's not my fault.
I am saving your life. Is cancer treatment necessarily harsh on the body? I mean, is it a mindset shift? Are we kind of understanding that it just has to be this way for now? I'm thinking back to what you said earlier about, look, you have a 10% chance, take it.
Yes, certain diseases, leukemia, testicular tumours and so on, those are highly curable with chemotherapy, so you should go for that. And if you have certain other illnesses which you can easily remove, let's say breast cancer, sometimes removing it will cure you, or nose cancer, you can just get some radiotherapy and cure you. So when the odds are with you, then you should go for it. When the odds are against you, then it needs a more careful decision about how aggressive do you want to be. But you'll find that very few patients, when you tell them there is even a 10 or 20% chance of cure, that they wouldn't want to take it. Most of them will say that I will still take that chance. So if you have lung cancer, even in stage 3, I would say your chance of cure is actually only about 15 or 20% with radiotherapy. But most of them say, never mind, doc, I will still want to try it. Right? And then we say that, okay, well, let's do this, but we'll keep your side effect manageable.
Coming back to immunotherapy, what happens after? I mean, if, so say my tumours are dormant or, it's silent, or I am quote-unquote cured or in remission, has my immune system fundamentally changed? Is everybody now very harsh and going around and interrogating all the cells and saying, show me your IC, show me your passport? have they changed?
Maybe they've upgraded themselves. They're just a bit more vigilant. It's not good to think about terrorism, but in a way, we've just gone one level of alertness higher. So you might recognize cells which are similar. Now, the one of the problems there is that it might go into a little bit of autoimmune. It might start to recognize anybody with long hair as alien and attacks with cells which are slightly different but are still normal cells. So we do have to be careful about that. And that is one of the things I was mentioned. Two patients died possibly of reaction to the cells. Maybe the immune system was over-enhanced and started attacking your normal cells as well.
So we're not quite there yet, but this is exciting baby step.
This is very exciting, especially when you consider that these are the patients who've had all the conventional therapies and essentially there's nothing left in the basket for them.
Mm. Right now, when you look at your options in that basket, how do you go about deciding what is right for who and what? At what point does alternative treatment enter that? Because I understand, as you say, that right now it's kind of like you're trying to move immunotherapy or targeted therapies further up that list of priorities. So as it stands, if you meet somebody new and you've diagnosed them with cancer, how do you determine what's going to be suitable?
If we look at the setting, is it going to be for cure or to control the cancer? So if you go for cure, I will say that we are going for cure here. Why don't you complete your treatment? After that, whatever alternative you want to try, I am quite happy for you to do that. But don't interfere with your curative therapy first. Now, if you're in the setting where the cancer is advanced, and what I'll say is that we are going to give you treatment so that we can control this cancer. So they will say that, okay, but can I try something else first? Then I will, then again, I'll approach it as, okay, if you want to try something else, how long do you need? Is it a month, 2 months? Okay, if you want 2 months, we will scan you again 2 months. If it's bigger, would you agree to start treatment then? If it's smaller, fine. Okay, wow, this is a bit of a shock to me, but I would say, never mind, whatever you're doing is working, please carry on. Mm. So we will do that for them.
Okay. I mean, I'm very, very excited because I've learned a lot myself today. But one of the things that for my shallow life, I read a lot of all these magazines. Of course, what is applicable these days is the whole Angelina Jolie effect, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. And cancer. Yes. So, you know, because when we did the talk back, we had somebody who called back and, you know, said that, you know, what about these prevention? And then prevention to the extent of screening yourself to look at your risk and that sort of thing. I'm scared of the future that you can have a swab in your mouth and then you can find out what sort of cancer you can get. Do you ever think that we're ever going to get into that
scenario? Why are you scared? I want to armchair, you know, therapy
right. Yeah,
you.
Okay,
why are you frightened?
I'm scared for two reasons. I'm scared to find out what it's harboring in my body and then what my genetic makeup's going to be, my destination. And the second thing I'm scared about is probabilities. Whenever someone says to me that my probability of getting colon cancer is 65%, what does that mean? And I'm scared for my next generation because whatever I do will mean that whatever is passed on from me, I am responsible for finding out. I'm responsible for finding out for my kids as well and their kids. So, you know, is that responsible things to do to find out yourself? Then that will impact on other people. I'm fascinated because I'm quite sure you're going to be bombarded with questions like that tomorrow, right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. I really am interested in your opinion.
Yeah, we get a lot of this. You know, I live a healthy lifestyle. Nobody in my family has got cancer. Why did I get it? For most parts, the cancer is essentially a genetic disease. But for most part, we don't have very strong genes which are associated with cancer. Usually, it's a mixture of genes. You may have gene A, then C, E, F. Then when they work together, then they cause cancer. Angelina Jolie is rather unique because she's got a unique cancer, BRCA, which is very strongly associated with cancer. You also have other genes, such as the FAP gene, which essentially cause colon cancer in everybody with the abnormal gene by the time they're about 40. Mm. Now, it is useful when the family history is very strong that if you know that you have a gene and by 40 you're going to get cancer, then maybe you keep your colon until you're about 25, then you say bye-bye to it. And we've got patients who've got a familial type of thyroid cancer. So again, you know that by the time you're about 25, 30, you're going to get thyroid cancer. And the thyroid is not as important. If you remove the thyroid, you can still do replacement therapy. So it is wise that you get, if you have a familial cancer or say thyroid cancer, then you get your kids screened. And if they have that particular gene, then you say that, okay, unfortunately, my kids, by the time they're 20, we need to get your thyroid out. Mm-hmm. And you'll have a replacement therapy for the rest of your life. But it's a smaller surgery and certainly much better than getting a big surgery or aggressive cancer.
I feel like sentences like, your thyroid is not that important, can only be said by doctors. No one else believes you.
We can discard that.
It's like, you know, yeah, it's not that important.
In fact, when I was in the other side of the fence, I recently had a, you know, motorbike accident, and every single doctor's friend who came to visit me and said, well, it's only a spleen, we can get rid of it. But when you're on the receiving end, it's my spleen.
I want my spleen.
Don't take it out. Like, you know, it is interesting that, you know, Lynn pointed out that, you know, we made that calculated risk for patient to say it's only thyroid, it's only this, because we can always give you medication.
Who needs half your colon? You're fine.
You know, right. But I didn't say I would like to have my colon, but the thyroid is a relatively small.
Relatively.
The colon is a very, very big important organ.
You know, but, you know, somebody would actually do that calculated risk for Angelina Jolie to actually say that it's only your breast. You know, we can always reconstruct that. That's one thing that, it has to be patient who has got very strong awareness and insight into that to make that decision. And it is sometimes difficult to judge that, to gauge that. The other thing is that sometimes it's probability. Angelina Jolie's situation is like 82%.
That's right.
But when you actually get into a situation, BRCA in a man, prostate cancer is in the region of about 42%. How do you make that decision to say that I stand a 42% chance, should I take it out? And that is a very difficult decision, I think, because it's all figures. And how do you think 60% is you're likely or unlikely?
That's right. But you think of what's the consequence of the operation. And think, oh my God, I'm going to have some problems with certain things.
Yeah, well, you know, erectile dysfunction or incontinence, which That's is right, what yeah. men are worried about. So if you prophylactically remove that, and then, you know, you might end up wearing...
Diapers,
and that sort of things. It's not everyone. Obviously, it's a very small risk, you know, less than 5% in most surgeons' hands, but it is still a risk. And then that is an interesting future that we're going to get into.
That's right. And they'll probably ask you, are you sure I wasn't in the 60%, doc?
That's right. So that's the best part for me to say, Dr. Fuad will answer all your questions. I'll refer you to see him. Right.
I've been speaking to Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Datuk Dr. Fuad Ismail, senior consultant oncologist, about immunotherapy as a possible cure for cancer. Up next, we speak about patient education and the decision-making process when it comes to cancer treatment. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin with our doctor in the house, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. Joining us also is Professor Datuk Dr. Fuad Ismail, senior consultant oncologist. They're both going to be part of the BFM Health and Living Live 2016 event that is happening tomorrow. And one of the topics that we'll be discussing there is the management of cancer. Today, however, we're speaking about a new therapy that seemed to work with blood cancer patients. Okay, Dr. Rajesh Singh, who's also going to be at the event tomorrow, albeit in a different panel, he's an orthopedic surgeon. Now, he's big on patient education. He likes the idea that patients are going to be more informed, that they understand what it is that they're getting themselves into. And, you know, with Dr. George bringing up numbers and facts and figures, I don't care. It's my body. I don't care if it's a 98%, you know. You still have an attachment to your body. It's
your
yours.
Body parts,
yeah. So when it comes to cancer, what kinds of information or what does an informed patient look like? You know, what do you want a patient to come in understanding?
An informed patient, okay. Some patients are very informed. They've done their Google search and they'll come with a stack of papers for you. But most patients, when they actually try to do a search, I think they're a bit overwhelmed.
Mm.
They do search, they're very diligent for the first few days or first few weeks, and then after a while they say, oh my God, maybe it's easier if I just ask my doctor. So I would, in general, assume that the patient knows very little, and I'll start from scratch. Okay, this is what you had. This is the cancer. How did it grow? Where it might have spread? And then what has been
done? How much do you think they take in, they absorb that? Because sometimes they're very emotionally charged. You know, at that moment, they have just been told a bad news and they've been waiting since 7:30 outside your door for your 9 o'clock clinic to begin. And they go in, they got armed with all these Google that they've done the night before. Yeah. And then, you know, sometimes they can hear certain things that they want to hear. Or they, when they hear something, then that's kind of engraved in their mind. How do you overcome that? Because I find, in my practice, I find that a very difficult thing to do. Have to bring them back repeatedly. Sometimes they don't come back.
Good, that's a good point. Because sometimes when I see them after surgery, let's say they're still in the ward and I see them alone in the room, I say, I'm just here to say hello. Please come to my clinic and bring somebody. They come with the family and so on. And I doodle a lot. So as I'm talking to them, I'll draw up for them. And after that, I give the paper here. Why don't you take this? This is basically what I said. And you go back and digest it some more. I usually never ask the patient to make a decision there. And I say, go back, think about what I've said, come back if you want to talk some more and decide what you want to do. So giving them something to take home helps a lot. I would say that I would suggest this chemotherapy drug A, B, and C. This is how long you need. This is your schedule. And what are the other alternatives? So usually they have a little bit of paper. Sometimes they look, doc, can I have that? I say, yes, that's what I'm writing it for. It's for you.
And I suppose having a family member or a friend there helps to absorb more information because they're able to kind of talk it out with somebody later.
That's right. And sometimes they're afraid to ask you the question. They are trying to get your family member to ask you by proxy.
Yeah, sometimes you also have to gauge that sensitivity because, you know, you may have the family members coming to say you're not allowed to mention the word cancer. And also sometimes the family member think they are doing the patient a favor by hiding this, right? I always find your job very difficult because
yes.
Sometimes you have to beat around the bush, you know, like mention things around. Do you just be as direct as possible so that it's all laid out on the table as transparent as possible? Or do you have to follow that game with the patient's family requests?
in general, I try to be honest with them. But again, sometimes at the first consultation, you can't tell them too much, you know, even if they have... If they have advanced cancer, you say this cancer is advanced, but you don't say that. In general, you don't say that you know the chance of even 50% chance you're going to die in the first year and so on. So because you don't know, so you'll say that yes, your cancer has spread, but we have treatment options for you, and this is what we are going to do. Mm. Then on subsequent consultation, when they're a bit more comfortable with you, and then you can see how they're doing on treatment, then you slowly say, okay, your cancer is responding very well. It's much smaller, so this is what we're going to do, but. At some point in time, it's likely to grow again. So you cannot lie to them, but they do need to hear everything at one go. So you give them as and when it's necessary. Mm-hmm. I think that's a better approach.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time today. But if you have more questions about cancer treatment and management, come down. The panel will be starting at 1:30, but there's going to be lunch before that, and there's going to be other fabulous panels about a bunch of different things.
That's so unfair. You're going to have lunch before yours, and then mine's kind of like later on in the day.
You will still have lunch.
All right.
You can come for lunch, George.
I think I have my fair share of lunch in my life.
But yes, that is happening. That's all happening tomorrow. You know, we're talking about cancer today, but we're also going to be talking about hypertension, diabetes, and obesity. We're going to be talking about aging. Dr. George will be talking about fertility. So it's just all different things, and that's happening tomorrow at BFM Health and Living Live at Connection at Nexus Bangsa South. So do join us for that. It's from 10 to 5, and we'll be feeding you good food, and there'll be free tests.
There'll be goodie bags as well.
There will be
right?
goodie bags, yeah.
Is there some sort of like lucky draw as well, I heard?
There may be. I heard tell that, you know, prizes might go up to, you know, in the region of a total of 6,000. I heard.
Okay. So we'll keep that a secret. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, Lynn, I want to say something. You know, it's like, I think one of the things that BFN has done extremely well is actually decrease that taboo about cancer. About cancer. All right. One of the best things that BFM has done is actually, you know, diminish that taboo about cancer. Because to many people, families, you know, cancer is almost like a curse. But recently I heard a very great TED talk and then actually saying that actually these days, increasingly, cancer has been treated like a chronic disease. And then with that, a lot of people can be a bit more open and then they can actually discuss and understand their odds, the risk that they take when they accept therapy. Because in the modern days, I think the therapy itself has changed. And then I'm quite glad that Fuad has added a lot of kind of understanding towards those modern advancements. Isn't that true? There are huge amount of modern advancement that has changed in the last few decades. And perhaps, you know, with the diminished taboo about the word cancer, then patients can actually accept and listen to your advice.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. 20 years ago, you talk something as common as lung cancer. 20 years ago, the question was, do you need chemotherapy or not? Do you need chemotherapy or not? Now, it's more like a question, which chemotherapy are you going to get? It's not even a question that you shouldn't be treated. You should be treated because we are managing the side effects of chemotherapy. The chemotherapy is getting more effective in such a ways if you don't even try it, because we are keeping the side effects to a minimum.
And to close it off for today, you know, before we pick it up again tomorrow, what advice would you have for people listening about managing and, I suppose, living with cancer? Because that seems to be something that people are doing more of now.
Keep your options open. Always come with an open mind. Because some people, again, they come to me and say, "Doctor, I don't want chemotherapy." And I look at them, "But your chemotherapy is very gentle for your disease. Why don't you want to try?" Then they go, "I've heard so many bad things." Although everything is called, all the drugs are called chemotherapy, there are many, many different types of drugs now. For each cancer, we are using different types of drugs, but they're all lumped together as chemotherapy. So for your specific cancer, ask what are the side effects of this particular chemotherapy, not put everything as in general terms of nausea, weakness, and so on.
Thank you both very much for joining me today, and I'll see you bright and early tomorrow morning. I have been speaking today with Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, senior consultant oncologist, both of whom will be at BFM Health and Living Live 2016 tomorrow. You've been listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.